This is a parsha that most distinctly raises the question of theodicy, of rationalizing God's goodness, God's power, and the appearance of innocent suffering in the world. For very little cause, it would seem, Aaron's sons, Nadav and Abihu, as you saw in the Leah, are consumed by some supernal fire in reaction to some misdeed of their own, a strange or inappropriate fire they gathered. We discussed in Talmud once that there was a long history of priests dying while officiating in the temple. And I don't know if it was mythic or more of a cause of asphyxiation on the incense, but there seemed to be evidence of a little of both. So as we read the Torah reading last week and this, there was a great foreboding and a great sense that something very wicked this way comes. If you know that Nadab and Abihu are to die in a few short chapters, it's hard not to look at what's happening and what's preparing as they prepare the use of the tabernacle for the public and to try to figure out what's going wrong. And the only real evidence we have of miscalculation is that they add to God's fire with their own fire. As I noted, that it's all in the same aliyah, which is to say they wished to help, but maybe there was a sort of arrogance or impudence or chutzpah in bringing their own ketoret and their own incense when not requested. That's the best we can understand. Midrash offers a lot of causes because it's uncomfortable with the idea of them dying for very little cause. And this was intended to be a joyous day, the day of the inauguration of the tabernacle for public use, says Talmud in Megillah, was to be as joyous a day to God as the day on which heaven and earth were created. This situation of them bringing in excess fire is also doubly complicated because there are traditions that say that it was necessary to add to the supernal fire with one's own passions and intensity. So there is a counter tradition, not just that they died for extreme cases of arrogance and the fault of their own, but they died through no fault of their own, and that their death was actually a kind of bliss and reward. The Ora Chaim, the Chaim ibn Attar, writing in the 18th century in Morocco, says that they approached the supernal light out of their great love for the holy, for the Almighty, and thereby died. They died by divine kiss, such as experienced by the perfectly righteous, the kind of death that only Moses is accorded in Midrash. So it wasn't so bad. But life is chaotic, and life is filled with foreboding. I think through the past year, perhaps more than ever in some lives, and as we approach, God willing, a transition space in the pandemic, it's reasonable to have misgivings, if not foreboding. I mean, there's a certain amount of excitement and delight, but also what will be, there's no return to the status quo ante. So what will be the next version of reality? Our sages in Talmud also teach that things happen. Ha'olam noheg kamin hago. The world is measured and managed according to its own management schemes. That the organogram, the org chart of the world is distinct and isn't about rewarding good or punishing evil, but has its own inertia and its own momentum. Talmud says that there were four who died through the counsel of the serpent, which is to say, just by the mere fact of Adam and Eve listening to the serpent and introducing mortality into the world, that some die. There is no necessary cause of a particular event. That sometimes the cause is just random probability generation, as another rabbi would say. We live in a world, I think, says this parsha, among other messages, with a lot of uncertainty. As I said, maybe today more than at any other time in our lives, the uncertainty is intense. You know, we will near herd immunity perhaps this year, but Africa may not for 8 to 10 years. And the chance of COVID or another virus appearing or mutating is still there. And we recognize our own frailty, just as I think Shemini through the death of Nadav and Avihu, is forcing us to recognize and contend with mortality. So I think in its curious way, the Parsha invites us to control what we can control, to focus the ambit of our concern upon the things that are within our reach, right? And what is more in our reach than what we put in our mouths? And likewise, what comes out of our mouths. But the end of the Parsha, then roughly last third of the Torah readings, are about kashrut, are about laws of food. And it's previewed in something I read today, which is that the priest would be the one to help the people adjudicate between pure and impure, which is part of the structure of kashrut itself. So the most extreme example we have of what people put into their mouths is Aaron's rejection of eating the sacrifices after the death of his sons. He claims it's because of his own anxiety. He didn't know what went wrong and was afeared that should he eat, maybe it would become poisoned or inappropriate. But there's a variant reading I've heard that this is about what's called theistai, which is eating with God, commensality with the divine, as we saw in Exodus, table fellowship, sharing a meal with God, which is a large portion of the sacrifices are about, part going to the Almighty and part being consumed by priests and others. So Aaron is, in Aaron's anger, disappointment, and resentment, saying to God, I'm not going to eat with you. Another issue is the ways in which food teach us about ourselves, form community in that same way that Aaron deigns to form community with God, but that food, especially in Judaism, is a chance to make mitzvot and brachot, blessings and commandments, but also to make fellowship. So the board approved or inaugurated a transition towards Shabbat learning in the coming year. And one of our goals, Trish and I have discussed, along with Shuli and Serena, is to bring people into Kiddush, because at that table, as our sages knew from the era of the Mishnah, that table is a place of education and a kind of tabernacle in and of itself. So what I thought about also this week as we talk about rules of kashrut, or sort of a proto-kashrut that Shmini and Re'eh introduce in their parshiot, and the entophagy, I think the eating of insects like locusts and crickets, is modern questions of food security, especially in an era of climate change. But the one more immediate to us is what's called zoonotic illness. The tens of thousands of viruses that exist in wild animal populations, whether they're bats or pigs or pangolins. That COVID-19, far from being caused in a lab, was caused probably by human encroachment on pangolin and bat populations. And likewise, Jan Han illustrated to me through his daughter's research that the Nipah virus, prominent and prevalent in Bangladesh, can be tracked directly to human interaction with bats along a river basin. Maybe there's a sense of food being a sense of a place of danger, and certainly a place of abstinence and control. So to return to the thought of a world filled with peril and the unknown, and the possibility of controlling what we can control and focusing on that, not in an obsessive compulsive way, but in a way of recognizing how much we really do control, which is small. That abstaining is a kind of mastery, and choosing carefully, as Jose said to a comment in my YouTube video, that being a vegetarian is a nice choice. That the original choice for humankind in the time of Noah was to be a vegetarian. So withdrawing from all the things we want and taking only what we need is a very powerful Jewish impulse, not to be ascetic or monk-like, but to be moderate. And to an extent, you are what you eat. Nachmanides, the medieval scholar and mystic, was said, we are commanded not to eat animals of a cruel nature so that we might not absorb their quality into ourselves. But that basic human choice of what to eat is very powerful. And then also, as I said, what comes out of your mouth? The mouth being one of the few gates we really control, and one of the places to moderate choice and chaos amid the varieties and the vagaries of humans' lives. So I noticed in my own experience, to my embarrassment, I owe an apology to someone, that I didn't listen carefully enough recently. I was too busy with my own agenda, and it didn't just happen recently. I think it happens more frequently, and it happens to so many of us, to shut my darn mouth, right? The power of our mindfulness practice, based as it is on Quaker ceremonies and on 12-step, is that we shut our darn mouths. We listen without speech. And sometimes when we speak too much, we trample over the real agenda. And that's, I think, what happens. You might have noticed when I was chanting the part of Aaron Silence, I changed the dynamics and tempo a little bit to illustrate the power of his silence, Vayidom Aharon. And not just what goes into our mouths, but how much goes out of our mouths and the way that our words can trample other people's space, in as much as our eating can affect the natural world and trample the forests. Bacha ibn Pekuda, writing one of the first doctrines of Musar, which is ethical treatises, the duties of the heart, Chavot HaLevavot, says that one's calmness can overcome one's shock, and one can humbly accept a creator's decree and justify the divine judgment. Just as the verse tells of Aaron when Nadab and Abihu died, Aaron was silent. And David in Psalms said, "Be silent to God and wait patiently." And Amos says, "The wise shall keep silence." Our power is much smaller than we want it to be. And I every year feel more intensely that the central spiritual struggle in a human life is to acknowledge the limits of our control. But this one's always in our control. What we eat and what we say, and how much we eat and how much we speak, are very powerful spaces to express our awe, to recognize our fear, to recognize the limits of our control, and to abstain and only take what we need, but not what we want.